You are listening to Screenfish Radio. I'm your host, Steve Norton. Amidst the stunning landscapes of Monte Carlo, a young woman is surprised to find herself caught in the midst of a sweeping romance with eligible bachelor Maxim de Winter. When the two wed quickly, he brings her home to his elegant manor of Manderley. As the new Mrs. de Winter settles into their estate, she falls out of favor with housekeeper Mrs. Danvers, who remains devoted to the legacy of Maxim's first wife, Rebecca. This week, as we talk about Netflix's remake of Rebecca, we welcome back friends to the show Miriam Ibrahim and Amanda Jane Smith to talk about the film's portrayal of the relationship between power and gender and being haunted by toxic memories. Welcome to the conversation. Welcome to Screenfish. Decided to do this, that was by choice. I debated whether or not I would. I could have done so for quote unquote research, but I didn't want to watch it with that in my mind because it's such an iconic film. Best Picture winner, I believe.
Oh, yeah. So I didn't even know that like a Hitchcock film existed until after, because I finished around 9:30 and then I fell down the Google rabbit hole of like, is there a sequel? When was the book? I know there's an old book. When was it? Like, what's happened since then? That's the only reason I now know that Hitchcock made a film in 1940, but it wasn't known to me before that.
I didn't realize Laurence Olivier was Maxim de Winter in that one. Look at that. Here I am right now.
I'm looking at, I didn't know about the awards. Where are the awards?
I'm fairly certain it won Best Picture.
Oh yeah, won two Oscars. Best Picture.
Yeah, Best Picture and Best Cinematography. And Hitchcock was nominated. This is sort of seen as one of his classics. Everybody talks Psycho. Mm. But this is sort of seen as one of those sort of iconic films. But I've seen maybe as much as I love Hitchcock's work and my familiarity of directly seeing some of it is probably limited to three or four films. Had you read the book, Amanda, did you say?
Yeah, I'm going to wait till you record. Okay.
Welcome everyone. As you've heard, we are talking this week about Rebecca, and I am so thrilled to have back two of my favorite guests, Amanda Jane Smith. Do you prefer the Jane in there?
I you know, it's funny. I put the Jane because I was trying so desperately to give myself something to distinguish from the million other Amanda Smiths. But then every time someone actually says it, I think, oh God, it's so pretentious and preposterous.
I don't think so, but...
So I'm easy, whichever one.
Well, Amanda Jane Smith and Miriam Ibrahim, welcome back, ladies. I love it when you can come on. So thank you for joining me as we talk about...
Thanks for having us. It's always fun.
Definitely. Thank you.
Rebecca, the remake of the famed 1940 Oscar winner, directed by Alfred Hitchcock, is a Netflix film that stars Armie Hammer and Lily. Oh, man, I'm losing it.
Lily James.
Lily James.
Thank you, Lily James. And tells the story of an unnamed woman who I cannot wait to talk about that, who meets a dashing, debonair single man whose wife has just died, Maxim de Winter, played by Armie Hammer. And as the two begin a whirlwind romance, he brings her home and her life is turned upside down by the mysterious and rather grumpy Mrs. Danvers, who lives in the house as well. As always, this podcast is rated S for spoilers, and it is on Netflix if you are looking for it. But ladies, let's talk about it. What did you think of Rebecca?
I didn't know entirely what to expect. I'm not a fan of horror or scary films, so very glad that it wasn't that, but I wasn't quite sure. One of the things that I just is so impressive to me is that it was completely unpredictable. So there were several twists, having not read the book or seen the original film, that I just didn't see coming. And I spend a good amount of my time when I'm watching movies going, oh, I think this is going to happen. Oh, I think this is the motivation. Oh. Yeah. And I was wrong every single time.
Oh, cool.
Which made for kind of a neat film. Like, I mean, I was close sometimes, but I think it made for a really interesting movie. I haven't fully decided if I thoroughly enjoyed it, but I really appreciated that it kept me on my toes.
Mm. Yeah, that is neat. I'm also, Miriam, someone who loves to write the script as it's going along. And anybody who's sitting watching a movie with me, which that doesn't happen anymore now that we're in a pandemic, but prior to that, I would be quite annoying co-viewing friend because they'd be like, stop! Especially if I was right, because then it's like... I'm trying to enjoy the movie.
Yes. I've been in that position myself a couple times.
Yeah. You're not the person that goes, he did it. Are you?
Close. Yeah.
Totally did. He did it.
Yes. Yeah. I guess. Yeah. That's exactly what I
think. Yeah. Sometimes too, like if things are based on authors, if you've read an author enough, you pick up on their pattern and their formula. Right. So if you watch something going, oh, but this is written by so-and-so, things are going too well. Something bad's about to happen, probably to that person. And then it does.
Like I haven't watched very much This Is Us, but when I did watch it, I was like, oh, we haven't cried for 10 minutes. There's going to be a monologue that makes us break out into tears pretty soon.
Yeah.
But that also says something to the level of proficiency, or we've been a TV viewing audience for so long now. Like our entire lives, we've had cinema and television, and we've had cinema and television move from showy to more naturalistic and then to meta. And audiences are really savvy now. So we're almost... a collaborator, or we make it sort of interactive, even though it's still only a one-sided experience. We're different than watchers, audiences were 50 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Very true.
Which is perhaps why, if you were to compare the old Rebecca to the new, you'd see maybe why they wanted to make it very different and keep you guessing.
Mm-hmm. Now, have you seen the original? Like I was saying before, I deliberately didn't when we were podcasting because I didn't want the legacy of this film hanging over my head as I watched this one. I would love to go back and watch it, but I haven't seen it. So have you seen that?
Yes. I read Rebecca in university and I loved it. And then I went and watched the Hitchcock movie, but that was 20 years ago. So I forgot so much. So when I saw the marketing for the Netflix Rebecca, I got really excited and remembered, oh yeah, there's this book that I loved. It was awesome. I don't really remember all the details. There was a husband, there was romance, there was a twist. And then I did the thing. I reread the book just before watching Netflix. And I don't actually that often set myself up to watch something that is a book adaptation to a movie and go, oh, no, they didn't. Cause I'm the first one to say, like, it's an adaptation. It's one person's perspective. It's one director's take, you know, and you take liberties and you take the context and put it in 2020, you know? But despite all that logic and rationale, I sat watching the Netflix movie and little by little, I grew increasingly disappointed because it just is such a good story. And I would say probably my number one complaint is why they decided not to make it a miniseries. If there was ever, you have so much rich, dense material. I don't know, it's 400 or 500 pages, the book, whatever it is. You have so many wonderful moments to flesh out characters, to draw out the plot and the arc so that the payoff at the end is so rich and great. And to cram all that into 2 hours, or maybe it's a little less, I was just like, I don't get it. I would love to have been a fly on the wall in that network meeting where they decided to not go the miniseries direction to understand what their logic may have been for making that decision.
That's so interesting. I never even considered that possibility, but you're right. It's Netflix. It was released on Netflix. They could absolutely run a miniseries versus a film. I often am disappointed by, I never like the movie as much as the book if I love the book. So my strategy for that is I always watch the movie first. Because if I watch the movie first, I'm always, richness is added by the story in the book. But usually the way around, to your point, you're like, oh, but there was this part and it's not expressed properly. And yeah.
I wanted to like this. As it went on, I was sort of like, what's going on? But I felt like this film was very, again, I haven't seen it. I don't have the familiarity with the book. I felt it was very segmented. Like it was sort of like, okay, here's the romance. Mm-hmm. Now we've got the Danvers part. Mm-hmm. Now we've got the Rebecca Boat part. Now we've got the trial part. And I thought, there's a lot of parts. Like I sort of thought it would sort of flow as a film. And I didn't feel like it did. Like, I mean, I'm not saying I didn't hate it. Like, I didn't come out of it saying that was terrible. Now, most people I know that said that, like I said before, are in love with the original. Oh, it's a classic. Oh, it's this. That's why I didn't want to watch it. But there was something about it. And I went, it was missing something. Ladies, please forgive me for this question. I must juke to the left because it is a question that is on my mind.
Okay.
Is Armie Hammer attractive? Is he?
Really? That's your question?
Yeah.
Because it didn't feel right? The casting didn't feel right to you?
No. Okay. Let me rewind a minute here, okay? Let me rewind. People have been drooling over Armie Hammer for the last few years. And I get it, but I also don't get it. There's something about Armie Hammer. I don't dislike him, but I don't know. I don't get it. Like, he doesn't have a lot of range, or at least I haven't seen Call Me By Your Name, which I hear he's fantastic in. But from what I've seen him in, I have not seen a lot of range.
Did you see The Man from U.N.C.L.E.?
Yes. I saw it. Okay. I don't hate the man. I don't wish him ill.
Yeah.
And I hear ladies fawning over his name. And I don't get it. I said to my wife, I said to Alicia, I said, is Armie Hammer hot? And she said, well, he's attractive, but I wouldn't kill for him. And I thought that was a great answer.
I want to know who she would kill for. Yeah.
Hugh Jackman. I know she'd kill for Hugh Jackman. When I'm watching the film, and I heard at one point he was going to be Batman, and I thought he would be good for Batman because he has he's got the sort of chiseled feature.
He's very chiseled. He's the cartoon character. He's he's ridiculous. He's Roman like type look to him that I think gets him in the door. You know, if you're casting and you're thinking first about aesthetic, and sometimes I think, I'm not saying he isn't talented. I do think he is.
No. I think he is.
Right. But like when I saw him in The Social Network, that was the first time I'd ever seen him. And I was bowled over. And the reason was, A, it's a great film. And whenever you're watching a great film, everybody in it is great. Automatically, it just, everybody levels up. Mm-hmm. And so I just thought he was fantastic. But I also thought it was the right character meeting the right actor. You know, it was just that stodgy, wealthy, white, Harvard, you know, men of Harvard. Even the way he talks, he's got like a bit of a funny mouth, but it works for that character in that movie. It was perfect. And then you plop him and take him and put him somewhere else. Funnily enough, you talk about Batman, because I feel that's the same thing with Robert Pattinson, where he is a funny looking dude, but when he's a vampire, he's gorgeous. Like, he's great. And then you put him in a different movie and it's like, what is going on? I don't know. So whether or not you think he's good looking is a relative term, right? I think good looks come with personality, which is probably why your wife loves Hugh Jackman, because she probably loves a personality like Hugh Jackman's. And just to bring it back to Rebecca, I have nothing. I think Armie Hammer he definitely is talented, and he is cursed with a ridiculously good looking face. But I do not think he filled the boots of Maxim De Winter in this film. But I also didn't love the film, so there you go. That's the opposite of you know how I felt about The Social Network, where everybody's kind of not at their best, because I don't think the sum of its parts added up to a great film.
That's
fair. Yeah, it's a charisma issue then. Maybe it's a charisma issue in this film. Maybe it is located just in this film. I didn't think he felt awkward.
But I think, so it's interesting because my take on it is a little bit different. So I agree that I think he's quite handsome aesthetically, like he's quite good looking. And I think that he played the role very reserved, which is maybe what came off as a bit stiff or awkward, but it makes sense to me in terms of the story. Like, I think it was a very purposeful acting choice to drive, because the whole movie, our unnamed heroine narrator can't tell.
Yeah.
Right? Her whole thought stream is he's so in love with Rebecca who passed that he can't even bring himself to talk about her. And his bursts of rage are unexpected, volcanic, and related to him being overwhelmed by grief was her assumption of it, which really only works if he is being that reserved. Yeah. Because otherwise we would draw different conclusions as the audience. And the point is for us not to, and to be surprised by it. It reminds me a little bit of, and you guys are going to kill me because it's not nearly as cinematic, but it reminds me a little bit of like the criticism that Hayden Christensen got for playing Anakin Skywalker, right? They were like, he's so whiny and he's so da-da-da. And I was like, yeah, he totally is. But then when you think about the characters or even like Luke's character at the beginning of A New Hope, and you're like, he's supposed to be whiny. So he just did it so well that people thought it was his nature and not him acting a character well. And so like, to me, that's what, so I definitely agree that he was quite, it reminded me a lot of some of the, almost like an old black and white with like a Jimmy Stewart or a Cary Grant, like that element of complete reserve and being a little bit kind of stilted. But I felt like it was
Grant. Cary Grant is not stilted. Cary Grant is, he's George Clooney. You walk into a room and there's some sort of charisma about Cary Grant that lights up the screen. Like, I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
Well, maybe,
no.
Maybe then it's a question of, I'm totally on flow with what Miriam's saying about, he needed to carry himself. Like, Maxim de Winter is reserved. He's so reserved that for 300 pages or, you know, for almost an entire movie, his own wife doesn't know how he's truly feeling. And so in order to pull that off, I think it's a collaboration between actor, director, and editor to make sure that that illusion or that fine balancing act gets pulled off. And I think they let Armie Hammer down because he was probably doing his best to fill those boots and to get that illusion across. But there weren't the, you know, the occasional close-up of his face or the allowance of a scene where you peek a little bit more into an inner conflict that he's having. And when it culminates in the boathouse scene where he's, you know, having a drink and then confessing to her that he killed Rebecca, it was so choppy and it didn't allow him to finally have his moment, you know, to let all of what, what do we call her? Lily James's character.
Mrs. De Winter.
I don't know. I unraveled my thoughts there, but come together.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think that was supposed to be the crescendo of the film, really, right? Like, that was the moment. And then,
well, it had a bunch of mini crescendos. It had, so he reveals he killed her, and then Lily James has a very quiet moment of, oh my God, he's not in love. Like, he never loved his wife. He loves me, because that's all she cares about, right? She is a young woman in love and just tormented by whether or not he loves her back. And then there's another moment of they have to go to court now and because they've found a new body. And then there's the potentially being bribed by the cousin, blackmail.
Oh, the blackmail.
And was she having a baby? And then the final reveal of she was actually dying of cancer. And yeah. So, yeah, there's a bunch of mini crescendos. And maybe even the fire, you would argue, is another one.
Yeah, that's a good call out. I wonder, to your point, those are all things that could potentially have been very well resolved with a mini series. Because I wonder if it was a function of just editing in time. Because I did also feel, and I didn't realize this till I fell down the Google rabbit hole after watching the film, because I haven't read the book or seen the original film. She's supposed to be half his age. So he's 42 and yep. She's very early 20. Yep. And I'm not sure that that's clearly portrayed. And even when he gives her the line of what I hate is that she's taken away from you, your innocence and your naivety and how you approach the world.
Yes.
Yeah. And I thought that could be such a powerful thing. We didn't get to fully see that realized or actualized. It seemed almost like a snap of the fingers when she realized that he loved her and wasn't still kind of in love with and attached to his dead first wife. So I think like it seemed like a pretty big like snap of the fingers switch. We didn't see her develop as a character into maturity. We saw he's actually in love with me and not in love with his dead first wife. And then suddenly she becomes super smart about don't say anything, do this. Oh, this guy's looking for blackmail. Like, where did that come from?
That's exactly what I'm saying. It just felt like it was boxes and Manderley, which
there you go. You didn't talk about Manderley in the summary at the beginning. How could you forget Manderley?
Oh, I can't. I know. I'm a Xanadu man myself. But anyway. excuse me. A little too much sun in the windows. No. Manderley. When Manderley goes up in flames, you'd think I'd care more. Like, the way that it just sort of like, they drove back and they're like, oh, it's on fire. And then they run away from it. And I'm like, This is the burning of Manderley.
Yeah, your family legacy.
This is the death of a character in the film. The Manderley that was the one thing I loved about the film. It is gorgeous. This movie is stunning. Like,
it is stylish. It's a music video. I feel like it's more of a music video.
Like an 80s video? Like,
no, I guess I mean there's more style than substance.
Yes, I like that. I like that you said that. Because, I mean, everything about the visuals and even just the cinematography, I was transfixed. It was gorgeous.
Music choices were very interesting.
Yes. Yeah.
It was,
that's what I mean. Like, that stuff was, there was flash and there was beauty. And Manderley is a prison with it's, you know, I mean, before they get to Manderley, it's like, you know, I don't know where they are, the Sorbonne or France. I'm not even sure where they are at the beginning.
Monte Carlo.
It's bright. It's sweeping. It's cinematic. And when they get to Manderley, once you get inside that house, it's almost like the house is closing in on you from the patterns on the floor to the pictures on the walls to the frame. Yeah. It's just, and the colors are dark. Like, the only thing I've seen like that recently is The Nest. If you've seen
I want to see that.
So good.
Yeah.
So good. I loved it. With
Jude Law,
Carrie Coon. Fantastic. But again, just like this film, the house is a character.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of the film, they burn it to the ground and then they flash away. Mm. And I thought, wasn't the whole point of Manderley was that it was like, his identity was tied up in this home.
This home, yeah.
It's funny. The entire crux of his motivation for before even killing, marrying Rebecca, discovering what a horrendous person she truly is, and then deciding to stay with her and put up with all the horrible things she does is in the name of nobility. In that stoic British nobility of like, this house and our reputation is it's what matters to me. So much so that we need to then buy into a gorgeous, successful, rich man like Maxim de Winter foregoing love and being pushed to the brink of finally murdering his wife. Mm-hmm. And then, you're right. After all that, the symbolism of that nobility, it goes up in flames and there's so little reverence for that.
Yeah, and it's actually, now that you say that, it's interesting that the story doesn't follow him from there, right? So you see it burning, and then I get that she's the narrator, but it follows her and not him.
Do you guys want to know what happens in the book?
Yes.
Yes.
Please.
Nothing. The last page is Manderly going up in flames as they're driving up, and she doesn't even write about them realizing and putting two and two together. It's just at the moment that they're looking at the horizon and embers, you know, red embers are starting to float into their viewpoint. Yeah. And that's it. You have no idea what's going to happen to them, their future happiness. She leaves it completely hanging for you.
Does Danvers kill herself in the book?
Miss Danvers sets the fire, I believe that's actually.
Yeah. Sets the fire and disappears, right? No?
Well, in the book,
you don't know.
I can't remember. I have such a bad habit of blending everything together once I've seen it, but yeah. I don't even know if we know Miss Danvers set the fire in the book.
Hmm.
Isn't that interesting?
Oh, yes. Yes. They have a phone call. They're in London proper, and they get a phone call, and Maxim's uneasy because he says that Danvers gave in her notice and left hastily and packed up all her things. And it leaves him. He comes back to the table, and he's kind of mulling that over, and he's feeling uneasy and says, I think we should go back to the house tonight. So I think that was enough of a seed to plant in the reader's mind to then connect the dots there.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah.
But no, she doesn't kill herself.
My first theory was absolutely that he married the second Mrs. De Winter entirely for the opportunity for heirs. So because he made such a big deal about the home being passed down from his grandfather to his father and his father to him. And if he has no heirs, it goes to his sister, and not that that's terrible, but she's not a De Winter anymore. And so it was the carrying on of that.
Mm-hmm. See, I will confess, like there were a few minutes where, I mean, it was late, where I sort of dozed off, and I went back and rewatched those few minutes. I admit it. Confession. but so I have seen the full film. There were things that I feel like I didn't fully understand. And maybe that's because of how it was told. Maybe that was the storytelling and the writing, but like, Alicia and I were talking about it like this morning, and I wasn't clear on things like that the other man was her cousin, or the murder was in a fit of rage. Like the way he's talking about it, it sounds like she held the gun to him, and then it almost sounded like his finger slipped, and I assumed it was an accidental.
Well, that, I mean, okay, so I've been kind of shredding this version, but I will have to say, in defense of adapting a book to a film, you have to look for all kinds of visual ways to tell what is usually told by this beautiful, rich narrative, right? Words. Right. And you have the inner dialogue, this narration told by Mrs. De Winter. And you don't have the luxury of that unless you decide to slap narration, like voiceover, right, onto a film. So that part, the whole gun thing and her murder, I wasn't actually that disappointed with that, because what happens is, Rebecca is so conniving. She comes back from London knowing that she's dying of cancer, right? Some sort of cervical or reproductive cancer. And she's got very little time left to live. And she's totally okay with allowing her husband, like she wants to bring him down and make him even miserable in death, because she knows she's going to kill herself. She knows she is. And when she sees him come to the boathouse, she didn't pre-plan it, but now that he's there, it's like, oh, how convenient. I can get him to do it swiftly for me. Mm-hmm. And I think Danvers says that at one point at a different time, you know, Rebecca always said she'd want to go quickly.
Yeah.
And so he doesn't come there planning to kill her. And I don't think she planned for him to kill her either, but he happened to bring a gun. And when he's there, she goes on a monologue telling him about how if she had a child, you know, he wouldn't even be able to tell if it was his or not. And wouldn't that be terrible for the De Winter name? So she's pushing him and pushing him and pushing him to the point where he sees nowhere else to go that he pulls the trigger. And I think they tried to convey that by that little bit of push-pull weird thing they were doing between
Lily and Army. Yeah.
And with the with the gun. But again, it like, I don't know how you guys would see that, having not read the book. I don't know how you'd be watching that and feel much gravitas behind it.
Yeah, he was trying to explain it, although, and it's funny because you even just said, you know, he wasn't going with the intention to kill her. He just happened to bring a gun. I was like, you know, as one does, just carry their gun around for whatever.
Well, he was bringing a gun because he thought she was with her cousin.
Oh, the cousin.
And she wanted to threaten the cousin.
Like,
little things, right, that the book will tell you that...
You wouldn't pick up from the film. It's true. Or even the... Because I did pick up, like, he did explain a little bit of her goading of him in the push and pull. Although I didn't understand why Lily James is his current wife, who has so little identity of her own that she doesn't even get a name in the book, right?
Mm-hmm.
Her entire identity is wrapped up in being Mrs. De Winter and his love and the mistress of Manderley. But... why would she hold the gun to him then? Like that part to me, I was like, I don't get this. Like I'm listening to what he's sharing. But then I wondered if he was really through his narrative, he was the one holding the gun to himself. She was just the puppet that was making it happen, which now, as you explain, parallels, I think, the situation with Rebecca maybe a little bit better. Right.
And I think also from a director point of view, I can imagine the director thinking, I want to string the audience along a little bit further to guess, maybe we think, oh my gosh, Lily James is horrified by the fact that her husband is a murderer. So maybe she is going to pull the trigger because she's so scared. And then she doesn't.
Well, you know, maybe we can talk about this a little bit too. I know Mira mentioned about her not having a name. And I think I would love to talk a little bit about gender in this film, because I feel like this is, I mean, it's certainly, I don't know when the book was written. I probably should know that.
1937 or 38, I think.
Oh, yeah. Really? So it was right before the film. Yeah. Oh, I didn't realize.
Yeah. That.
Okay.
Yeah.
But I feel like gender in this film plays with a number of things. You have a character who has no name. Living in the shadow of a woman who is only basically known by her first name, and a man who lives in the legacy of his father, who by the end is less than that. I don't know. The story had some really interesting interplay. I was wondering how you felt the film sort of looked at that relationship between gender and power.
Good question, especially as you bring in the context of the time in which it's set and written.
I've been mulling this over a bit and I haven't come to any sort of strong conclusion. I definitely think context plays a huge role. You know, like Rebecca De Mornay was, I think, in her 30s when she wrote this, in the 30s. And I mean, I don't know what life was like back in the 30s, but it certainly wasn't. There weren't as many opportunities for women as there are now. So I tend to want to commend De Mornay to an extent for how I feel like she was somewhat ahead of her time and somewhat of a feminist, even despite the annoying things like not naming your main character. But I think that was on purpose. And I think that loops back to Miriam when you were talking about Lily James or Mrs. De Winter. She does start out very shy and demure and second guessing herself. And by the end of the journey, I believe that De Mornay's intention was to give her character her voice, to have found her voice. But again, it's in the context of very aristocratic English 1930s. Like this is high wealth and privilege. And so one of the examples she gives for how Mrs. De Winter has come into her own is to decide that she's going to throw out the cold lunch because Miss Danvers tries to serve leftovers and Mrs. De Winter is like, actually, we'll be having fresh meat for lunch. It was like, oh my girl, like I get it. I get that we're like cheering for you now because you finally stood up to Miss Danvers. But in a way it's like, this is so bloody privileged, you know?
Yeah. No bread. It's okay. Eat cake. Like,
yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting as you're talking, the things that have come to mind for me as well is, I mean, we've made a lot of strides in terms of equality and certainly in terms of opportunity. We're in a very different place as women than we were in the 30s and 40s. And I can say this decisively as a single unmarried woman who lives alone, but is free to do so, right? I don't need a father or an uncle or a brother to manage my finances or to give me permission to have a job as maybe a secretary, which were real truths at that point in time. So we're certainly not where we need to be. And equality still remains somewhat elusive in a lot of areas. However, if we look at like the time period, and I think it even is very clearly displayed in the fact that we are first introduced to the soon-to-be Mrs. De Winter because she is a lady's companion to a rich and pretty obnoxious, very stereotypically obnoxious American socialite. It's quite wealthy. And she is in that position because there is nothing else she can do as someone with no family, which her obnoxious American employer very happily kind of throws in her face, right? The interesting thing I think about this, though, is that so we know that societally there is a huge power imbalance between men and women, and then an even more divided power imbalance between married and unmarried women, and then, of course, the wealthy and the unwealthy. So we're hitting a lot of different kind of imbalances and places where she is less privileged. Mm-hmm. And she goes from probably the least privileged position a woman at that time could have to the most privileged position a woman at that time could have. Mm-hmm. But the interesting thing I find about the film and the story, which is really powerful, is that our antagonist is actually not a male, but the master manipulator in all of this is Mrs. Danvers, who is another woman. And so I think that's a little bit, and I think it is a feminist theme, but I think it's also a little bit of that underlying, we'll let the men think that they're in control. But the truth is that society really actually functions because of the little subtle ways that we influence and direct. And I use this line a lot in life, but it just applies in so many ways. It's from My Big Fat Greek Wedding, where the mom says to the daughter, she's like, oh, you know, the dad is the man is the head of the house. She goes, yeah, the man may be the head, but the woman is the neck. Mm-hmm. And she turns the head any way she wants. And I think it is such a real play out of that kind of philosophy that, yes, on the surface, we don't own the decisions, but the impact we have with influence to try and direct and guide in this particular scenario, it is overwhelmingly the females that dominate in terms of power.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting that the movie is named after a character that never appears. Like, this is not called Maxim. It's not even called, like, Manderley. It's not called Danvers. It's called Rebecca. And his character in this film, to me, is really, really interesting because he has it all, but he hates it. He doesn't mind being rich, and he doesn't seem to very proud of this legacy that he has. He sort of has it. Maybe it's just my interpretation of, you know, maybe it's just the way Armie Hammer played it. But I sort of got the sense that he's in the line because he is in line. You know what I mean? It's sort of, to him, and it's all he knows.
I think he's also burdened by the responsibility of it.
Yeah.
He's responsible for quite a few people's lives as the lord of the manor, right? So,
and maintaining the legacy.
Yeah.
But even more than that, like when he talks about Rebecca, everybody always says how much he loves her. And he says, I hated her cruelty. I hated my cowardice. Here's a guy who doesn't understand, who seems to have lost any sense of power within his own home. Like, he's overwhelmed by the women in his life. And in some ways, as the case with Mrs. De Winter, it's interesting. The thing he says is, I hate what she's done to you. They've never spoken. But this legacy of Rebecca overshadows and controls everyone to this day.
Yeah.
And it's fascinating to me, so much so that he's even talking about how she has shaped his current wife.
Mm-hmm.
And as a male, and sorry, I shouldn't use air quotes for male, but I'm using that as the idea of male for the 1940s.
Yeah.
Like it's a fascinating, you know, it would be interesting to have seen how, again, I'd like to go back and watch the film, but to see how a story like this played out in 1940, because this is at a time, World War II, men were men. Mm-hmm. It was right before, you know, you go back and watch some of those film noir, which I love film noir, Hitchcock film noir. Actually, Hitchcock and sexuality is a fascinating look.
Mm.
Psycho is a fascinating, fascinating look at gender sexuality in some ways. But this is a time when, you know, like you look at the film noir films, men are men. You know, we are the, I remember watching, Kiss Me Deadly. And this is a guy that just rolls through, he dominates the scene and women and all this stuff. And this is not Maxim in this film. It's a fascinating sort of, from a male perspective, watching this, I think it's really interesting. He almost hates the expectations that are set upon him with this name and the women in his life.
Mm.
Yeah,
everybody seems to know who he is, but him.
There's four main male characters in the film, right? You've got Frank, you've got Maxim de Winter, you've got the conniving cousin, Flavelle. I can't remember his name.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got, and then the brother-in-law, who for the most part, the brother-in-law and even Frank are secondary characters. You don't see a lot of them. You don't get a real flavor for their personality or their allegiances too much. Like, they seem like nice, quiet guys, and that's the most you're going to find out about them, kind of thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so you really are only left with two male characters. Our main of the film, Mr. De Winter, who, to your point, just doesn't seem comfortable in his own skin, which makes sense considering he's hiding the fact that he actually loathes the his first wife that he murdered and is trying to take care of everybody and his estate and continue his legacy with his responsibility. And then you've got this horribly conniving, charming at first, cousin.
Mm.
And so it's an interesting juxtaposition because there is no heroic male character really in this film, right? There's anybody that you connect yourself to and go, yeah.
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 Mrs. De Winter is the strongest character by far by the end. And you're right. I think it was you, Amanda, that made the comment that by the end, she's sort of running the show, which is interesting because they say to her, you can't handle a home like this. And she said, I'll learn. Mm-hmm. And by the end, she has learned. Yeah. She's handling the home.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the switch gets flipped so quickly, I feel like, that it's a little jarring. But
yeah, but the power definitely in this story lies with the females, obviously with Rebecca. Rebecca had power through her beauty, her unmerciful strength. You know, I think they only reveal it once or twice when Danvers describes when she was a child of only 16 riding that horse for the first time. And all that was left by the time she'd finished with the horse was just like froth and blood, that she was fearless and strong and more than likely bisexual or sexually fluid and had no problem. Like, to her, sex was a game. Like, life was a game because she had learned how to master it and she played above social norms like marriage. And and then you have Danvers, and Danvers is a force in herself. Also probably, if not gender fluid, then she was fully a lesbian, although that's not the focal point of the film, but still pretty cool in the 1930s to have a character written this way and older. And can we just say, by the way, Kristen Scott Thomas is still so friggin' beautiful. Like, wow, she's just...
And she played this role so well. I had such disdain for Mrs. Danvers from pretty much the instant.
Yes.
She was like, you just did it so well.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh man, she is the best. So again, I know we're talking about Netflix, but the second time I revisited the Rebecca book, I actually listened to the audiobook. And it's narrated by an old actress, and I believe her name is Alexandria Okarma. And she was incredible. And so she's having this one-woman show doing the dialogue between Miss Danvers and Mrs. De Winter. And, oh, it's just so, so good and powerful between the two. And I think it's wonderful writing. Having said that, as a woman in 2012, it's a little disappointing to see the old woman, the unmarried, undersexed, obsessed with a dead woman is the meanie of the movie. And the young, beautiful, virginal, rags to riches woman is the one who is innocent and our heroine. And I get it. It's a retelling of a classic story. It's not like you're going to flip that. You know, that's exact. Mm. These are the characters. You can't go and change them. But yeah. My appetite for what gets me going when I watch films with strong female characters in them is like, oh, damn. I honestly, one of the most exciting moments in the film for me was when Miss Danvers is showing her the tapestries and the paintings on the wall and talks about the aunt who was the first doctor ever in England. And I was like, yeah, oh, yeah. I want to do a spin-off series about that woman.
Netflix has one in the books. They're probably working on it as we speak.
So maybe, but I hear what you're saying, Steve, about, you know, the men don't really hold a lot of power in this. And they, maybe I never even occurred to me to think from a male's perspective watching this movie, how it might've been a little wishy-washy or you'd feel lost or disappointed. And that's a great observation to make. I, as a female audience member and reader of the book, it didn't even really occur to me other than the fact that while I get the romantic notion of a man who is so hard to get, like he's so closed up. And in the end, you know, he finally, it all comes spilling out of him how much he deeply loves her. But again, speaking as someone who played that game, falling after men who were really hard to get, I'm like, ugh, this is an old trope. If you ask me, I would gladly now take a man who can communicate honestly and clearly from the start.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's courage. Committed to that ongoing conversation, right? Despite the fact that it's difficult. Yeah.
Yeah. And for the record, I mean, I found his character really interesting for that level as well. You know, I wanted to say to him, I'm like, dude, just pick a lane. Like, you know,
yeah.
You have no idea who you are. The entire film, he has no idea who he is. And
don't you think though that that's probably more true to life than we're often willing to admit. Like how many of us walk around pretty lost in terms of here's all the stuff I'm supposed to be responsible for, the stuff I'm supposed to want or be good at, or the feeling of duty that I carry. Mm. But is that really me? I don't know. Have I taken the time to examine, explore and decide? I don't know. Like, I think it is sadly more true to life than we would like it to be.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know what, when you say that, the other question that I had about this film that may be worth discussing is the idea of toxic memory. I'm patenting that. If it becomes a trend, the term of toxic
memory. Yeah, yeah. Hashtag okay. It.
Heard it here first.
Yeah.
but I think that plays out in this film in so many ways, because it's one thing to mourn your involvement in something that you've done, like he does. I'm not saying we should forget the past, and I'm not saying that at all. But this is a film where the past absolutely crushes souls.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Even Mrs. I keep wanting to call her Nurse Ratched, but that's a whole other
similar.
Danvers, they're not that different.
That's the ghost story part of this. It's that they're haunted by the baggage.
Yeah. Which again, I mean, and now I'm going to sound like a broken record, is so sadly more true to life than we realize. Mm. Right. How often have we behaved in certain ways and people are like, why are you doing this? Or why are you like that? Well, this one time when I was 14, this happened to me. And ever since then, I can't blah, blah, blah. Or I always blah, blah, blah. Or right. Like we get tied. Yeah.
I wonder if Du Maurier was here to have a conversation, you know, if it, that may have been her intention, was it was an exploration of the idea, the metaphor of how a lot of us are haunted by choices from our past and we can't move forward, or insecurity.
Yeah. And it's surprising how deeply it anchors. And I think to your point about toxic memory, Steve, like the thing we know about memories and how our brains work is the more we remember something, like the more we reminisce or go back or look at it, the deeper set that kind of neural pathway becomes. Mm. And so the more readily available the memory becomes, right? Mm. So we kind of rehearse ourselves into permanence a little bit in terms of retaining memories. But we also, of course, never remember something perfectly right.
Yeah, absolutely.
Always adding our own filters and interpretations and context to it.
Yeah.
And so that is also being reinforced and solidified every time we remember that memory.
Yeah.
So sometimes it makes toxic things get more toxic because we are reinforcing those parts of it.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It's interesting to play off that in this film. I mentioned about how dark and foreboding Manderley is until you get into Rebecca's room. Rebecca's room, blinding light. It is white. It is flawless. It is perfect. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't even really care that it's kept that way. She does. Danvers does.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one of the things I thought was so interesting in this film. It's completely reinforced over and over again. You cannot be her. You cannot be her. You are not her. I'm Mrs. De Winter. No, you're not. And there's this effort to keep the past alive in a way that is damaging the present and the future.
Sure.
That I think it just flows through the story, and I thought was a really fascinating look for it, because I'm not saying, you know, hey dude, you killed your wife, forget about it, move on. I'm not saying that. But it is really interesting that the hold that she still has on him in the present, and like I said before, how the hold that she's got over the home. Look, what I don't like what she's doing to you. She's not around.
Yeah, but they are purposefully keeping her alive.
Yeah.
Right. Even her room, which, funny, you talk about how it's like blinding and light. It just felt really cold to me. I was like,
sterile.
Yes, very much. But from her like negligee being on the bed to all of on her vanity, like all of her hairbrush and her comb and everything was monogrammed. And all you see is her monogram everywhere in the house, right? In the drawer, on the notebooks. And it's a very intentional action by, I'm assuming, Mrs. Danvers, but it is also perpetuated by every other member of the house and the household, right? They allow it to continue. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes that happens when somebody passes, especially if you idolize them, you create a shrine to them almost, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm willing to bet if they were real people and not characters, or if we had a lot of backstory on the relationship between Mrs. Danvers and Rebecca, I'd be willing to put money on Rebecca was probably pretty cruel to Mrs. Danvers as well, at least at a couple points in time. But part of the obsessive, like this was the one person in life that I loved and the most important person to me, is when they've passed, as part of our nostalgia, we idealize the best parts of that relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And we kind of don't pay as much attention to the parts that weren't great. We do that with past relationships too, right? Anytime you've ever been like really tired or really lonely or a little bit drunk and you're like, why did I break up? We shouldn't be. We would be. We were so lovely. It was so great, right? Like,
totally.
Yeah. And it is because we like to kind of romanticize and idealize, and we kind of filter out or blur the stuff that wasn't great. And that's what they've done with Rebecca's memory. They've built out this like ideal Rebecca.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The idea. Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting because the others had sort of a passing knowledge of her, or seemed to. And Danvers has a more, when I use the term intimate, I don't mean to suggest anything between them, but I mean a more intimate knowledge of her. And he his knowledge of her is just hatred. Mm. He can't even see her. You know, when she comes down, his wife comes down the red dress, like, it's, don't wear that.
Yeah.
Turn around. And it's like, go, like, the memory of her is filled with rage.
Mm-hmm.
But again,
well, he's also haunted, right? Because he killed her not long after she showed up wearing that dress. It jolts him back to one of his last memories of Rebecca standing, you know, at the top of the stairs before the ball in the red dress. And it's like he's seen a ghost, because Rebecca is someone who probably in the last moments of her life said, you know, this isn't over, or I'm still going to win, Maxim. And then he's haunted by how that prophecy is coming true, that she can even somehow show up in his new wife, who was supposed to be untainted by this.
Yeah.
I remembered one more thing to say about Armie Hammer, since this has become an unofficial podcast on Armie Hammer. What I like about Armie in the few movies I have seen him in, and he came on the scene, I think he got nominated for some stuff when he was in The Social Network. Like, he just blew up all of a sudden and probably had a lot of offers to do a lot of things after that. And then he started making some really smart choices, right? Like Call Me By Your Name, I think, was a really smart choice to show his chops and to do something more indie. And I like when he chooses to do films where he is supporting female stories.
Yes.
I think that's cool. I give him props for that.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Oh, because, and the other one that I saw him in recently was Ruth Bader Ginsburg. What's it called?
Oh, yes. He was good in that. On the
Basis. Something of Sex.
Basis of Sex. On the Basis Thank of you very sex. Much.
Yeah.
He was and again, good. He is the support to.
He's Ruth Bader Ginsburg's husband. That's the character.
Yeah. So not always easy, right? It's not always easy to be the support. You don't get to have the really meaty dialogue sometimes, or those really beautiful close-ups. Your story has to be secondary, but still carry weight and be supportive to informing the main story.
Yeah.
Which women have been doing forever in cinema. So I don't need to give them too many cookies, but still, I think it's cool.
Yeah, I'm with you. I have a question for both of you. And I know I just saw it yesterday, but there is one part of the film, and I know, Steve, you already talked about how it felt kind of choppy and it sort of felt like five stories that we pieced together. But the very, very end, they wake up in Cairo. You realize that it's actually been a retrospective on their time from when she met him through Manderley. She starts looking through their honeymoon photos again. And then he wakes up, particularly amorous, I guess, that morning.
Oh, yes.
And so they start, you know, getting intimate. And then she just, and obviously it's a purposeful cinematic choice. You see his back and she looks straight into the camera.
Mm-hmm.
What on earth is that supposed to mean? I don't get it.
Yep. What do you think, Steve?
I saw that and I had the same question. My assumption, honestly, was that she had taken on the role. It was sort of like she was looking to the camera as, it felt like a puppet master move. It felt like very self-aware. And I could have been fought way off, but when I saw that, it was because of the change in her character by the end of the film. My first reaction was, has she now become the one who is in control? She controls the gaze.
I thought of Sandy from Grease, and I thought of Bella from Twilight, and I thought of that archetype of the demure, shy girl who falls in love and journeys to find her voice, and at some point becomes the vixen. Like, remember in Grease when she decides to smoke a cigarette and be all
in love? Tell me about it, Stad. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And now she's come into her sexuality. And then Bella becomes really vampy when she becomes a vampire. And also they choose the same thing where she looks right at the screen with her now vampy eyes. Right. And there's probably 100 other iterations of that. But yeah, I would agree. I think she's coming into her own. It's a little disappointing that still some of the cinema tricks for how to show a woman coming into her own is pouring herself a glass of booze at what is looks like morning time and then smoking a cigarette and then French kissing her husband and looking at us because, but maybe that is just the go-to to get the point across quickly because they clearly had to wrap up the movie quickly. But it could also be that if you are someone who's a diehard fan of the idea of the ghost of Rebecca, maybe she's embodied a bit of Rebecca's energy now, which is a bit of a cynical view of it.
That might work for me. Like what I saw at the very end and the movie scenes that it reminded me of, and I really don't like scary movies, so I haven't seen a lot of them. And I can't remember if it's Alien or like The Astronaut's Wife or something. But it's one of the ones where basically the female that's left standing at the end has actually been taken over and impregnated by the aliens that they were trying to eliminate. And so you get that like last minute stare into the camera, which is the secret of the ominous truth that the evil is going to continue on. And that was,
I think they do that in Annihilation too.
Like that's kind of visually what it reminded me of. And I was like, oh, wait a minute. What does that mean?
Now she's Rebecca.
No.
I think that's probably, that was sort of the assumption I got. And I think under the, based on how the story was playing out, I think it makes a lot of sense. Ladies, I'm really enjoying this. I could keep going. I think we should start wrapping up. Let's screen it or skip it. Rebecca, screen it or skip it. Screen it or skip it.
Oh, you know what? Screen it.
Because it's Netflix and you're not going out of your way to pay extra for it, I would also say screen it. Like I would have felt frustrated to go see it in a theater, but it's worth watching online.
If I'm allowed to have a caveat, I would say screen it, but then do yourself a favor and enrich in your life so much more by reading the book or listening to the audiobook or watching the older film, because man, is it ever a wonderful, wonderful story.
Right. You know, having watched it, like I said, it's beautiful. It's cinematic. I'm not going to go with screen it on this one. I'm going to go skip it. Not because it's terrible, because it isn't. But it's not a must catch. And there are lots of other things you can check out on streaming as well. But you could, I mean, like, I think that it is an interesting caveat to say that you don't have to pay for it in the theaters, so you can, and you'll probably enjoy yourself. So it's not like, you know, I came away from it and I felt sort of lukewarm to it, but enough that I'm not going to go all in, but.
It's good for good discussion. Like if we weren't talking about it today, I probably would like it less. I'd be like, oh, I don't know how I feel about this. And I can't walk through that with anybody, but this has given me the opportunity for that, which makes it pretty cool actually.
Yeah, I agree. This conversation has been so much more fulfilling for me than watching the film.
But let's be real. There's a whole bunch of people out there who they just want 2 hours to check out from the stress of life. And you know, there's no more Downton Abbey. So they need something where people walk upstairs and downstairs wearing stuffy outfits, drinking tea. So
ladies, thank you so much. Always so much fun having you on. I really
thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. And for all of you at home, a reminder, you can get us wherever podcasts are available, including, including Manderley.
Yes. Manderley. Oh, based on a real place. Not called Manderley, but something like that. So maybe it's still there.
I hope so. I hope it didn't burn to the ground or some people can be really upset.
If you're there and you're watching, listen to the podcast. How cool would that be?
Yeah, that's right. and if you go to the podcast page, you can download Fishing for More, which are small group questions you can have with the people that you watch the film with as well. But, yet again, lady, one of you, not both of you, ladies, thank you so much. And for you at home, we started the conversation. This was Screenfish.